Good afternoon and welcome to today's insight session, Securing Our Digital Future. We have all heard about the cyber attacks in recent years where the damage can be very costly, both financially and in terms of reputation. Well-known examples include the 2015 Ukrainian power grid, where approximately 225,000 customers were impacted by a service outage. The 2016 Panama Papers data exfiltration, where 2.6 terabytes of confidential tax-relating data was leaked to offshore accounts and they were stolen and published. And more recently, the 2015 worldwide WannaCry ransomware attack. Today, Ian will be discussing some of the challenges that we as a society face, potential solutions, and what the upcoming notifiable data breaches scheme could mean. Ian has a diverse technology background from a variety of industries around the globe. He has held CIO and executive transformation roles in Australia's largest general insurers, providing leadership to drive this large company through digital change. Please join me in welcoming Ian.
Thanks very much. Just a quick sound check. Is everyone can hear me? Excellent. Turn that on. And I've gone. Yep. So, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for that introduction. And as you can tell, it's interesting times indeed. We've had WannaCry, we've had Petya, we've had the Australian government announcing that they're going to set up a cyber war unit. And just the other day, we've also had Equifax getting slammed in the press for losing 143 million customer records. Today, they actually announced it's gone up by another 2.5 million. It seems every day we hear about some form of cyber attack, ransomware, identity theft. And in just a short period of time, hacking has gone from something that a couple of bored teenagers might get up to for a bit of a laugh, to being a highly targeted weapon wielded by sophisticated criminal organisations and governments with you and me's collateral damage. The digital age has brought in many advancements, but history has also shown that advancements can be perverted by individuals and nations to the detriment of all humankind. But is this a problem? I mean, it happens, yes. We still have car accidents. Doesn't stop us jumping into our cars and driving them as fast as we possibly can. Is this just more of the same? So today I want to tackle three things. First of all, what is the current situation? Secondly, what impact is that happening? Is that having on us as an organisation around the world? And then finally, what, if anything, should we be doing about it? Sorry, I'm just recovering from a bit of a cold. Look, these are fantastic devices, aren't they? Despite the fact that we use them primarily to send photos of our food to family and friends, they can bring the information of the world into the palm of our hands. I can do my banking, I can book airline tickets, I can collaborate with people, I can set up alerts to make me aware instantly of events breaking anywhere in the world. We should be the most informed population on the history of this planet. But instead of utopia, what we're actually seeing is increased polarisation of opinion, driving partisan politics. Has the digital revolution, which brought us the global economy, now started to push us down the path of increased protectionism and nationalism? Well, I had lunch with Condoleezza Rice. It was just Condoleezza and myself and about 250 close and personal friends. But she was asked this exact question about the polarisation of politics in the US, and her answer was actually quite illuminating. What she said was that when she was a child, right across the states, there was probably about six Today shows. So the entire population of America was getting virtually the same information and having the same debate. Today, with 150 plus channels, What people tend to do is that they only listen to those channels that currently reflect their own opinion. So they're not getting that diversity. And therefore, when they do hear something that's different, their immediate reaction is that they're either wrong or they're stupid. And I think that she is right on the money. The Age published a fantastic article in 2016 titled "Don't Blame Facebook, We're the Real Culprits." I recommend that you actually look it up. And it was making virtually the same argument, where that what we've seen is that people follow those whose opinions reflect their own, and they do not seek diversity. And let's face it, this is how our apps are written these days. I buy a book on Amazon, and it says, oh, people who bought this book also looked at the following books. You play a song on Spotify you like, and it starts playing other music. You may never have heard that music, but it actually sounds pretty good. So am I really broadening my horizon, or am I just going deeper and deeper down my self-selected silo? It is a bit scary to think that the digital technology is actually highlighting and accelerating some of the worst of human behaviours. But to allow me to do my banking, to book my airline tickets, requires me to have all of the data required to complete that transaction available in digital format and then exposed through a variety of applications. Now, whilst this allows companies and governments to be far more efficient and effective and therefore drive customer satisfaction, what it also means, we have built up an enormous pile of enormous pool of data. And that pool of data has become a target for criminal organisations and other governments. The Internet of Things is increasing both the size of that pool and its influence every day. So how do the hackers do this? How do they actually get in and take our data? Well, there's four basic techniques. And any attack you hear about is a combination generally of two of those. So the four ones are zero-day vulnerability, denial of service, man in the middle, and phishing. So let's talk about those. First of all, zero-day vulnerability. I'm pretty sure that the people who developed the entertainment system of this cheap Cherokee never envisaged that it would be hacked into and used to take control of this car as it went down the highway, away from the driver and off the road. It was a white hack, by the way, it was under controlled conditions, but that's exactly what happened. Now, what the hackers did is they exploited what's known as a zero-day vulnerability. In other words, there's a vulnerability in the code. It's called zero-day because the manufacturer knows nothing about it until the attack occurs and therefore have no time to react to it. Denial of service. Denial of service is where you absolutely hammer a whole stream of requests against a website, so much so that the website can't handle that number of requests, it can't handle requests coming in from legitimate users, and if you keep it up long enough and hard enough, most websites will fall over and crash. A distributed denial of service, or DDoS, is where instead of all of those requests coming from a single IP address, they're coming from tens, if not hundreds, of IP addresses, making it extremely hard, if not impossible, to stop. If you'd like to talk to someone who has first-hand experience on DDoS attacks, I thoroughly recommend you give the federal government census department a ring. They know all about it. Man in the middle. Man in the middle is where someone hacks into and is actually sitting between you and the application. So you may think you're communicating with Facebook, but actually all of your transactions are being intercepted by the attacker. They're inspecting them and then passing them on to Facebook and then doing the same thing on the way back. This technique is extremely popular with certain governments. The Syrian government in particular has been using this extremely successfully for the past 6 to 7 years to identify and crack down on those people it considers to be dissidents. Phishing. Phishing, spear phishing, whaling, it's all pretty much the same thing. What this is where you receive an email, supposedly from someone you know or trust, and it can be blatantly like, send me all your banking details, or it can be more sophisticated and it'll have an attachment or a link which will be enticing you to either download the attachment or select the link. Should you do that, there's a very good chance you have just compromised your PC. In other words, someone can take it over. There's been a whole range of very high profile phishing attacks. It's estimated that 80% of all cyber attacks start with a phishing attack. So the Sony attack, where in 2014, where they lost a lot of data and the CEO finally had to resign. You have, as was mentioned, the Ukraine power grid in 2015. Now, in that situation, the attack actually occurred that brought down the grid in December of 2015, but the phishing attack started 6 months earlier, in June of that year. And that's where the attackers, generally accepted to be the Russian government, actually started a very sophisticated phishing campaign, and then over a period of 6 months, slowly built up access to a whole range of systems and processes. Consequently, when they did decide to hit the attack in December, they did so with what I'd say clinical brutality. It was a three-phase attack, pardon the pun, and they brought down 70% of the Ukraine power grid. I had lunch with Kevin Mitnick. Now, Kevin started his hacking career in 1979 at the age of 16. He was eventually caught and he spent a year in jail. When he came out, he continued to hack, this time far more, shall we say, broadly and deeply. And he ended up being on the run for 2.5 years and even made it onto the FBI's most wanted list. He was eventually caught and this time spent 5.5 years in jail, 6 months of which was in solitary confinement. According to Kevin, he was given the 6 months solitary because the prosecutors convinced the judge that Kevin had the ability to whistle down a phone line and create a nuclear holocaust. Now, when Kevin came out, he, like many other celebrity hackers, set up his own security company, and he now consults for a whole range of multinational companies and governments, including the FBI. And Kevin entertained us. There was just a small group of 12. It was an interesting lunch. And his preferred way of attacking a company is through phishing. Now, what he does is that when he's asked to get into a particular company, he'll go on to LinkedIn and he'll have a look at various people, get profiles of the, not the top level, but probably the next level down of the executive group. He won't go into the IT guys. They could be a little bit more savvy. Finance, maybe actuaries, who knows? And he'll look at their LinkedIn profile and also their Facebook. It will hack into both those accounts and get a lot of information about you. And then you'll receive an email that you pretty much are certain has come from one of your friends that's one of your connections on LinkedIn. It'll have all the livery of the company that that person belongs to, and it'll have something relevant to you and what that person does. You know, hi Joe, this brochure tells you all about our latest product, and it could be a genuine brochure that he's actually just added a little bit of code to. If you download that brochure, or if you select the link, you know, click this link to get to the brochure, then you have compromised your PC. So then at about 10 o'clock at night, somewhere between 10 and 2 in the morning, he and his team will then take over the PCs that have been compromised, and they'll start looking for two things. They'll look for a phone book, and they'll look for the PC that has the security on it. That's where you go and get your pass to give you access to floors 1, 3 and 5, etc. The reason why they're after the phone books and this particular thing is to identify the database analysts, the DBAs. Because if they can get on to find where they are, get to their PCs, then good DBAs belong in strong security. They've got access to lots of databases. And because they believe in strong security, they'll go for 16 hexadecimal passwords. They're pretty tough to remember, so they'll actually have them stored on their PC. And the rest, as they say, they go through. Now, this is not a secret. Kevin's not making a secret of this. Kevin's telling everyone. You can read what I've just told you on the internet in many, many places. So surely phishing as a means of attacking is passe. You know, we're all aware of it now. It doesn't work. Well, wrong. I said 80% of all attacks start with a phishing attack. They estimate that 50% of all phishing attacks are successful. Now, that seems to be backed up, that statement, with this data from the Friedrich Alexander University in Nuremberg, where they did a range of studies, and the bottom line of these studies was the fact that in 78% of people who knew that it was dangerous to select links in suspicious emails still did so. So we haven't learned our lesson. We think we're invulnerable and that technology will save us. And look, technology is getting better. But as I said earlier, every advancement has countermeasures, and it's not going to keep you protected. So that's people. Okay, what about companies? Surely companies have got it better together and they can do something about it. So just we're all friends here, just the people in the room, show of hands, who believes that their company has been successfully penetrated in the last 6 months? Well, we have a couple of honest people. Not the saying that you're lying, but I think you're optimistic. I had lunch with the CIO of Visa, and it was just much more intimate. There was just three of us. I have to say, I was absolutely in awe at the sheer volume of transactions that Visa handle on every second of every day throughout the year. It is mind-blowing. And what their CIO said, it's all a question of mindset. They know that they are a target for every man and his dog. And so what they do is they make sure that they do everything they can to stop them. They have their black teams, their white teams, they have this, they have that. They spend an enormous amount of time, effort, and money to protect your data and their reputation. I also had lunch that trip with the CIO of Symantec. One of the great things of being a CIO yourself is you get to meet some interesting people. Now, the CIO of Symantec said that he breaks companies around the world into two groups. Those who know they've been hacked into successfully, and those who have been hacked into successfully who don't know about it. And he said it's actually quite amazing the number of times that they will go to organisations, and some of these are top tier companies, and say, do you know you have actually had a data breach? And the company will be in total denial. And it's not until you actually outlay all of the evidence that they will somewhat reluctantly agree that, yeah, okay, we've been breached. Now, is he just a lone wolf saying that, or is there any evidence to say that this is what's going on? Well, I think that he was absolutely on the money. Again, this time it's Barclay data. And what they did is they actually polled 100 companies who had been successfully breached in 2016. And what they found was that 45% of those companies felt that their IT budget would not increase in the following year. 7% actually believed that their IT budget would be reduced in the following year. But to me, the most scary piece that came out of this particular bit of study was that 52% of the companies who had been breached successfully had no plans to change their security protocols as a result of that breach. It is incredible head-in-the-sand material. When the WannaCry ransomware attack occurred, it really made it into the headlines. And I can't help but wonder that was because of some of the institutions that were being affected, mainly the public hospitals in the UK. It's a bit hard to hide that. But I do wonder how many companies that were absolutely affected that chose not to own up. Now, owning up may no longer be an option. Certainly Australia and a number of other countries have already started and have passed legislation that you have to now report a data breach. In Australia, it was actually passed in February of this year, and it's waiting royal assent. I believe it's going to become law and effective from the 22nd of February next year. And in that, you have 30 days to admit to a data breach. Once you've discovered you have been breached, you have 30 days to report it. If you fail to report it, it's a $1.8 million fine. The European Union has a lot more teeth. They passed their legislation last year. I think it becomes effective in May or April next year. In their legislation, you have 72 hours once you have been made aware of a data breach. And if you fail to report it, you will be liable to a fine of either 20 million euro or 4% of your global turnover, whatever is greater. I can't help wonder what Apple would be up for if it was ever prosecuted under that sort of legislation. But I think that this is what we have to do to force companies to realise that this is a real thing. But who's the bad guy? Who's actually doing this? Well, we all know about those bored teenagers who are, shall I say, doing their apprenticeships. But it is obviously the work of criminal organisations, some of them highly sophisticated. But the lines between good and bad are getting increasingly blurred, because a large proportion of cyber attacks are actually government-sponsored. There's also increasing an alarming trend where certain of these very sophisticated criminal organisations, there's evidence to suggest that they have now started to share both their data and information with certain governments in return for those governments turning a blind eye to their activities. I mentioned WannaCry a number of times. When it first occurred, it was believed that it was a zero-day vulnerability. In other words, this is the first time we've ever seen any of this. However, when they analysed the code, what they found was that some of that code had been previously written by the CIA, in other words, the US government. And Microsoft is on record for criticising the US government for hoarding vulnerabilities and not making them aware of them. Why would a government get involved in cyber activity? Well, it's certainly a lot cheaper to fill a room full of hackers than it is to buy the latest military aircraft. But also, governments have learnt that it's also far more efficient and effective to collect information on their citizens and the institutions and citizens of other countries using cyber techniques. The Australian government set up or announced that they're setting up a cyber war unit. And cyber war is a term that was coined back in 2010 with Stuxnet. Now, Stuxnet was an attack against the Iranian nuclear facility, supposedly by the Americans, the American government, with a little help from their Israeli friends. The analyst on the documentary I was watching said whoever wrote the Stuxnet code must have had a gang of lawyers hanging over their shoulder, because the code was incredibly clinical, not only on what it did do, but what it was prevented from doing. It was absolutely targeted at the centrifuges of the Iranian facility and only those pieces of equipment. It was, as I said, very successful. It sent the centrifuges out of control, a number of them self-destructed, and it's estimated it put the Iranian program back anything from 18 months to 3 years. However, you could say it was too successful, because what happened, it made a lot of governments around the world sit up and take note. And they realised that what had just happened to Iran could equally happen to them. And as a consequence of that, various governments around the world have been setting up cyber war units, both offensive and defensive, since that time. Australia's just joined that group. So what does this mean? Well, it certainly means that our government is not necessarily going to reveal all the vulnerabilities it is aware of, because it'll hoard those to them and keep it to themselves so that they can pursue the agendas that it has. And so there is an increasing voice to say, well, if they are going to do that, then the governments have to consider what the impact, what the collateral damage will be on the citizens of their country, just like they need to consider what the collateral damage of any other weapon that they hold. But whilst governments can be the aggressor, they are also often the victim. And one thing about this digital economy is that it's very clear that information that is kept in digital format is easy to hack into and steal where it's being stored. And not only that, it's very easy to remove large quantities of it. 143 million records. If that was in paper, you would need a couple of semi-trailers to take it out. But you could probably fit that on a USB stick. And so what's been going on since, you know, WikiLeaks is probably the most famous one, certainly for the US government, starting in, I think, 2006, and even up to Hillary Clinton's failed presidential campaign. But the rich and famous, shall we say, have also found that they're vulnerable in the same way, with the publication of 11.5 million records from the Panamanian Law Company. And the ramifications of that sheer volume and who's involved is going to be felt for a long time to come. So, okay, just a show of hands in the room again. Who's had their credit card compromised in some manner, shape or form in the last 5-10 years? Yep, pretty much all of us. We're all impacted. And I've spoken a lot about what happens, you know, how the hackers get hold of your data. So what do they do when they've got it? Well, obviously they use it to do things like take money off your credit card. If they don't use it themselves, they on-sell it, and it's a viable black market. And there's easy ways of doing estimates of how much of this is going on as far as actual financial work, but what is very difficult to get a concrete sort of scale on is identity theft. That is absolutely it's becoming a tsunami, but it's very hard to get a good report on it. And a lot of the stories you hear are anecdotal. For instance, the wife of a good friend of mine has just gone through 3 months of, shall I say, fairly pure hell. What happened in her case was that someone got hold of her date of birth and her address, forged her driver's license, and walked out of a Telstra shop with an iPhone 7. Hardly the crime of the century. But it has taken her 3 months with Telstra, debt collecting agencies, the police, lawyers, the telecommunication ombudsman, to clear her name. Now, I'm pleased to say that Telstra agreed that she didn't do that herself and will no longer pursue her. However, part of me is just wondering if, should she ever choose to become a legitimate Telstra customer in the future, if there's not some little database somewhere that hasn't been properly corrected and what the impact is going to be in her case. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I really tried to find some place that said, we're through the worst. You know, we're going to burst out into sunshine. It's all downhill. But I'm afraid, you know, even the most wacky sites were in violent agreement that it's not going to get better. In fact, it's going to get a lot worse. And just here on the screen, you've got quotes from a variety of, this is the 2017 security report. So AT&T is saying there's going to be a 45% increase. Cisco are saying there's a 221% increase in compromised WordPress sites. Dell saying that malware attacks are doubling to 8.19 billion. It's not going to stop. So what's the effect of that? Does that mean that the digital revolution is over? It's going to slow down. We're going to throw away our smartphones. The IBM golf ball typewriter is going to make a massive comeback. No. Obviously not. Digital has put itself into our DNA. And there are too many advantages to the way our society works, the way our world works. We are not going to walk away from it. But at the same time, why don't we live in fear? I mean, this is happening to us all the time, and it's really back down to the fact that if one person is under threat, they can panic and things happen. When an entire population gets under threat, it's amazing that they don't. And you can see, you know, instances of this. I'll use the Second World War, the bombing campaigns, both against in England and in across Germany by the Allies, that people were being bombed every day and every night, and yet they didn't panic. And each day they went to work. And if anything, their morale almost stayed high under this incredible threat. Certainly from my personal situation, the only thing that my kids are frightened about as far as the internet goes is running out of data. But does this mean nothing's going to happen? No. I think that the internet itself is going to have a major hiccup sometime in the next 5 to 10 years, probably closer to 5 than 10. And the reason I say that is that at its core, the internet hasn't changed since it was invented way back when. And it still is a trusted network between academics. Security was never put in at the ground level. The internet has survived until today through two reasons. One, security by obscurity, and secondly, the lack of targeted technology. So what do I mean by that? Well, security by obscurity is never really a defense. What it's essentially saying is that this stuff is so complex, nobody can understand it, and you can't find out about it. Well, that's not true. Kids coming out of uni, everything you want to know as to how the internet works, how it's administrated, is available to anyone who wants to look, and it's quite easy to understand. The second part, which is the specific sort of technology, what I'm referring to there is the fact that the internet is still administered, by and large, in a manual process. The change in technology that's come up recently is in the building of artificial intelligence and bots. And you only have to think what's happened in the share trading and futures exchanges due to artificial intelligence and bots to see what could actually happen if somebody made a concerted attack against the internet. And there have been instances of this, that where you have manual processes and you're up against artificial bots, the bots will always win. And domains and other areas of the internet can be swapped into ownership by, shall we say, not the right people. So do I think that the internet's going to fall over, it's going to blow up? No. I think this is more of a cyber war attack than one from a criminal organisation. And I think that something is going to grow up alongside or on top of, but there will be a hiccup. Okay, so it's all doom and gloom. We just run out of here and that's the end. Or is there something that we should be doing about it? Well, absolutely. Now, with a given time, I'm just going to concentrate on things that we should be doing as corporations and not talk about what we should be doing in the personal space. And there's lots of things you can and should be doing there. Again, I've tried to keep the list short, but there's 8. I'm sorry about that, but I think that they are all very important. And they are patching, security by design, coding standards, data management, hack traps or honeypots, and then the last 3 are education, governance, and diversity of thought. So let's just quickly go through those. So the first one, patching. Now look, anyone who works in any sort of space, and I think it applies to you actuaries who are dealing with these sort of sophisticated models, if you don't keep your systems fully patched, you are exposing your company to significant risk. The reason vendors put out patches are to solve bugs, yes, but also block vulnerabilities that they've been made aware of. And if you wanted any further proof of that, read in the press today with Equifax that the reason that they were able to get in and take what they were was because the system wasn't patched back in March when it was meant to have been patched. So if they had done that patching, they believe that this attack would not have been successful. Security by design. We talked about that Jeep that was run off the road and about the fact that the people who designed the entertainment system had no idea that someone would try and use it and hack in the way they did. What this means that everything you build, you've got to start thinking about how someone could actually pervert what you have. Now, I'm making this next bit up, but I'm pretty sure I'm close to the money. Not just the entertainment system. What I'd like to understand is why did the engine control system accept a command from the entertainment system? It does not make sense. The entertainment system should not be telling the car what to do. But it was. It was allowed to just accept web service calls from anywhere. So you have to build this sort of security in right at the ground level. Coding standards. Again, look, there's lots of tools out there that, and it's not just the fact of writing good code and things like that. Where I'm going with this one, and I think it applies just as much to the actuarial models you write, is that it's an accepted development technique is to download libraries off the internet, because they give you access and allow you to do rich functionality in a shorter period of time, etc., etc. But what you want to do is make sure that people aren't downloading off the internet libraries that are actually compromised. And this is where the coding standard tools, such as, name's gone out of my head at the moment, can help you, because they will allow only those libraries that you have actually accepted and checked. Data management. Again, I think this is very applicable in the actuarial space. That is where we can't all have the money that Visa has. I mean, they spend some serious cash doing what they do. An alternative, which they actually do themselves, is it's not a one-size-fits-all. The days of just having a ring around the DMZ and the firewall are long gone. What you need to do is categorise your data as to what's really important and what's not. So you can have top secret, confidential, everything else. If you do that, then you can build layers of security far more efficiently and also much more cost-effectively to really protect the key pieces of data. And let's face it, as actuaries, you are playing around with the crown jewels of each of your companies. The data you have is super important, and that's what other people want to get hold of. So data management is extremely important in that space. Hack traps, honeypots, very simple technique. What these are is you could have a database in your system and you'll call it passwords. Now, your team knows that it's just rubbish, don't touch it. But an intruder coming in doesn't know that. They'll be looking around and go, oh, there's a database called passwords, I'll have a look at that. As soon as they touch it, you can have it set up so that it can either fire off a silent alarm to let you know someone's intruding, or you can even have it more sophisticated so it actually shuts down the system to prevent any further loss of data. But these techniques are fairly straightforward, they're not hard to do. So now we come down to the last three, and these are super important. All of the others are really hygiene factors you must have. The next three, I can't emphasise how important they are. So first of all, education. We've heard that 80% of attacks start with a phishing attack. 50% of people of phishing attacks are successful. 78% of people who know they shouldn't touch suspicious links and emails still do. The only way you are going to protect yourself against phishing attacks is through education. And it's no good to say, oh yeah, we've got a page on the intranet, we've got that covered. This is something that has to be living and breathing, almost a standing agenda item on your weekly meetings. And help each other to understand the impact that this can have. Now, some companies are doing a variety of things. There's one company I know that has a large purple icon in the Outlook toolbar. So if you receive a suspicious email, you highlight the email, you hit the icon, and it sends the email off to the security team so that they can analyze it. Because they're not always aware of all of the emails that are coming through into the system. There's another company that will sending out dummy phishing emails. So if you do hit the link and say, ha, you've done something wrong, don't do that again. One I read about, which I thought was a novel technique, is if you hit the link, it'll go, ha ha, you've done something wrong, but also, congratulations, you have been re-enrolled in Security 101 and your manager has also been informed. Whatever floats your boat, whatever you think is going to be effective, but I cannot emphasize how vulnerable your company is to phishing attacks. Governance. I'm sure a number of you are sitting here saying, look, I think we've got this covered. You know, we've got the security policy and gosh, we had the auditors in last week and it was hell, but they all gave us a green tick, so I think we're pretty good. Forgive me if I challenge that. And I'll use two examples. They're a little bit extreme, but I think that they prove my point. Back in 1988, there was an oil rig off in the North Sea known as Piper Alpha. At 10 o'clock at night in 1988, there was an explosion. 2 hours later, the entire rig was destroyed and 167 people had lost their lives. Now, there was obviously a major investigation due to such a calamity, and the Cullen report, Lord Cullen led it, and I actually remember listening to him deliver his findings. And I didn't keep count at the time, but I would say there was at least 10, if not 15 or more, separate processes, procedures, physical safety cutouts, electronic trips, any one of which would have either prevented that explosion happening in the first place, or even if it had occurred, would have prevented anyone from losing their lives. And yet, every single one of these independent and separate processes, procedures, physical safety, electronic trips had either been forgotten, ignored, not maintained, or even decommissioned. Despite the fact that Piper Alpha had gone through numerous safety audits and passed with flying colours, 167 people lost their lives. Fukushima. Okay, you could probably again make an argument that in the 1960s, when this plant was built, the Japanese government or the people who built it were not aware that a large tsunami would actually hit that part of the coastline. However, by the early 90s, there was concrete evidence that not only could, but a 15.5-metre tsunami would hit that part of the coastline. And yet for 18 years, nothing was done about it. So what I'm saying is that we can have our processes and our procedures, and we can have our audit teams, but we've all been there. I mean, I know what it's like. Someone knocks on your door, says, hi, I'm from audit, I'm here to help you. You go, yeah, okay. But we've got to change the way that we look at things, particularly when it comes to cyber. That we are just as much the problem as everyone else. And it's not the job of the governance team and the board to let us know that this is important. Let me ask a question to the people here to help illustrate my point. There's no wrong answer to this, but why does a car have brakes? Anyone like to give me an answer?
So you can stop.
Thank you. Does anyone have another answer? It's a perfectly correct answer, by the way. Anyone else? Okay. Let me say, in this context, that's what I call the governance answer. A car has brakes to stop. If I was looking at it from a business point of view, I'd say a car has brakes to allow it to go really fast and to take corners and to do all of those things. And let's face it, that's why we have processes and procedures. They're not there to stop us. They are there to allow us to do things very efficiently and effectively at maximum speed with a predictable outcome. And yet, in so many companies, audit and governance is seen as a way of stopping you. And I've had this argument numerous times with CISOs around the time where they say, oh, I found the team, they're putting data into the public cloud, we're going to block that. Absolutely, I fully understand, I fully agree. You can't put the crown jewels of the company out into a public thing because it's going to get taken. However, before you just go out and block it, because if that's all you do, the business are going to say, right, it'll be like whack-a-mole. You block this and something else will proc up. What you need to do is understand why is the business doing that? What is it they're trying to do? Are they trying to collaborate with customers? Is it the only way they can share large amounts of data with other organisations? What is the reasoning? And if you understand that and you provide an equivalent but safe technique to allow them to continue working the way that they want to work, then you will actually get a meeting of minds. And they'll see you as, oh, okay, you're not here to stop us. You're here to get us working effectively. and you'll get a far better outcome. But we have to change the way that we look at governance. Otherwise, we are going to continue to have disasters. In this case, loss of life. In our cases, it'll be huge amounts of data going out and extreme embarrassment, not to mention identity theft for goodness knows how many of those customers that we've now compromised. And if you ever wanted anything more to know, this is the most target industry sectors. Okay, last one, and that's diversity of thought. History is littered with innovators, everyone from Alexander the Great through to IKEA. And what these people did is they came up with something different that allowed them to dominate for a period of time. What we tend to forget or not look at is what these people actually did is they took on the establishment. And the establishment had its ways and methods of doing things and had its thoughts on things. And these guys were coming up with something that challenged that. And in each and every case of the ones who were successful, the establishment didn't realise its threat until it was too late. I think a great example of that is Singapore in the late 30s. Now, in 1938, the British government finished a major upgrade of the dockyards and defences of Singapore to the tune of today's money of over £2.5 billion. As we know, they had all the guns pointing out to sea because they, the establishment, believed that you couldn't attack Singapore from the land. Now, we also know the Japanese had failed to read that manual, and 4 years later, they attacked Singapore from the land, and after a short battle, Singapore fell. What is not as well known, because it's only been declassified after 70 years, is that the British government and the British military in 1936 had received written reports from MI5 and a number of others to say Singapore can be attacked from the land, and this is how it can be done. And by the way, what they wrote down was exactly what the Japanese did 4 years later. But that flew in the face of groupthink from the establishment. And it was ignored, and those reports were buried, literally, and probably the people who wrote them. So what I'm saying here is that if we are going to be successful in this attack against us with the cyber techniques, we're going to have to park our prejudices, our feeling of invulnerability, and embrace people around our tables who think differently to the way we do. If we do not, we are going to be doomed. Now, I'm told it's customary to finish these talks with a quotation, so here's mine. It supposedly was said by Abraham Lincoln, and he said, "The best way to predict the future is to create it." So, ladies and gentlemen, my challenge to all of you here today is that will future generations look back at us as those who created the future, or they are going to see us as the establishment that got blindsided? Thank you very much. So I'm happy to take questions either from the room or on the WebA. Last time I did, I got 400 questions. Do you believe that? Yeah.
Thank you. Mine is about the phishing attacks and clicking on links. So are you saying that we shouldn't be clicking on any links or that we should only be clicking on trusted links?
Yes. it's a really good and it's a difficult thing because the really sophisticated attacks, the sort of stuff that Kevin Mitnick comes up with, I defy you to pick it as being a phishing attack. Luckily, they're the ones that are really after they're the highly sophisticated people. But 99% of phishing attacks, the email has, you know, funny English in it, it's got... And some of them you can actually hover over the link and you actually see where it's going to. Mm. And it might say IBM here, but it's going to U Butte cyber attack up there. So I think that And this is where it's important for your company to have an ability for you to flick these through to your security department and have them be able to check it out very quickly, is that always err on the side of caution. If this email has come from someone you don't know, or someone you haven't actually really touched base with for a long period of time, and you have any shadow of doubt, flick it through to security. Say, look, I don't know if this is me just being paranoid, but can you have a look at this?
Yeah, because I think the thing is, we're all busy people.
Yep.
And, you know, sometimes you just, you can easily find those ones that are, they're written in bad English. But if it's not one of those, and it's a, you're not always thinking, oh, I shouldn't click on this.
Yep.
And when you were talking, I was thinking of an email that I got a couple of days ago while I was on leave, and I came in today and thought, oh, I've got to get to that. And it was asking for some information that was somewhat personal, and luckily it didn't apply to me, but I replied to them and said, you know, I don't have anything to tell you. What do you want from me? But then I was sort of thinking, well, was that a real email? Or, you know, it didn't have a link, but I could have, if I'd just gone off and provided the information, they would have got a whole lot of stuff about me that perhaps, you know, if it wasn't a real email. And I did that because I was quick, you know, I was thinking, yep, okay, it looks like it's come from my compliance department and I'll just do it. But I didn't actually check the email to make sure that everything was kosher.
Yeah. Look, it's tough. But, yeah, I my only advice is err on the side of caution. Yes.
I really enjoyed that list of 8 points that you provided as advice of how you can improve the security in a company sense. And I think they're extremely practical points, but more so, in my view, for a corporate which has the resources there to implement a lot of those. But thinking on the other spectrum of the market, and say startups, which kind of might be a couple of people, they're already cash strapped, everyone's telling them they need to get legal advice as soon as possible, they need to pay for this, pay for that, they're finding it all out of their own back pocket. What advice would you give those sorts of companies about how they could improve the security of their, and a lot of them are dealing with smartphones and apps and
that's right.
A lot of data. So,
well, let me flip the question a little bit. If you're setting up a startup and you've got this great idea, and then what hits the press is not the fact that this is a fantastic idea, but you've just been hacked and all of your customers' data is now spread all over the internet, do you think you've got a successful business model? I think that that's unfortunately the reality. You have to put security and legal stuff up right up there at the beginning and build the security in. And it's actually, it's not that hard. You can get cloud providers that actually provide fully encrypted databases and all that. And yes, they are more expensive than the run-of-the-mill. But if you are doing that, particularly if you're collecting credit card information, well, for a start, no company should have credit card information within their borders. You use one of these companies that actually tokenise it all and do that sort of thing, and there's legislation around that. But to answer your question, you don't have an option. But a lot of it is really fundamental, grassroots, common sense, and it's not hard to set a lot of that up.
Maybe a step further.
Yep.
Say you do try and go down the best practice route and use specialist providers as kind of good government suggests. How do you still go that step further and identify the vulnerabilities after that? Maybe it's the way that the different providers talk to each other. Are there any services out there that allow you to kind of test your?
Look, there are a lot of companies that will say we can come and give you advice. I'd be somewhat skeptical about some of those because generally they're peddling some particular product that they have. I think that what you need to have is you need to have clever people within your own company, and you also have to have that diversity of thought, because what's happening is that everyone thinks along the same lines basically. I've got the supply chain, it's great. And the innovator or the disruptor comes along and says, I can do that, and just hits it. And if you're not thinking ahead, or you have people who can think in different ways, you can be caught like that. And getting someone with a three acronym badge that charges you $1 million to come and give you advice is not necessarily going to provide you that diversity of thought that you need. And certainly I've found that the people who are playing in that space of smartphones and startups actually have a lot more information than they really understand they have, and they know how that market works, and they can give some very good advice to each other. I think it's more networking than going with a big name.
Thanks, Ian. You've mentioned a lot about the corporate side of things, but I guess as individuals who utilise social media a lot, I imagine most of us are on LinkedIn. I don't doubt that some are on Facebook and Instagram and all these other sorts of things. It seems that the amount of data that's put up there, not necessarily information, actually makes it a heck of a lot easier for people to be able to, come together with a credible story, to try and get through people's defences, that we're actually doing a really great job of helping to build up the capacity of organisations to be able to attack us.
Absolutely. I read one report a little while ago that said that the largest user of Facebook was the Russian mafia for identity theft. And it exactly to your point. I think that, now you, I don't know if you've got kids, I do, you try and convince them not to put things up there, or the belief, oh, I've deleted it now. I'm sorry, there's no such thing as deleted. If you've put it up there, it is there forever, and someone can find it. And certainly whilst the likes of Facebook and WhatsApp and all of these applications are getting security, is getting it improved, then it's still not there. We then have the situation of governments demanding that certain of these organisations hand backdoor keys. We then have criminal organisations in cahoots with certain governments. So I think it's you just be careful what you decide to post at any given time.
Hi, you mentioned PCs get surrendered or compromised. Mm-hmm. Do Apples also get the same?
Yes.
Everything's the same.
It's a myth to think that people don't, apples can't get viruses. It's just that it was, where all that came from, it was cool to knock Microsoft, and all of the hackers didn't want to embarrass Apple. But look, is Apple a great operating system? Absolutely. And at the time, it was far more secure than Microsoft. But it's code. And also a worrying trend is SMSs now on your phone can actually do the same thing. They can compromise your phone. There is no thing that is totally safe.
Thank you for a really interesting talk and slightly depressing in some ways. So you hear that I'm supposed to change my pins regularly. I'm supposed to have different passwords for all my accounts, which I can't even remember then. What tips would you suggest that the top three things you should be doing, or are you just basically, is it more important just to be aware when you have been hacked so you can do something about it?
Well, look, I think there's some basic things you need to do. So, for example, if you have a PC and you surf the internet and you don't have a basic antivirus and firewall installed on that PC, a la Norton Internet Security, I think you're mad. As far as your passwords and your PINs, yes, I personally don't change mine, but I don't believe in these organisations that give me all your passwords and we'll keep them secure, because they can get hacked just as easily as anyone else and you've just given them everything. But the sort of technique I use is that I have a string of different passwords, and I don't remember them. I don't actually remember what's for what, but I have a document that is encrypted, and it has it all there, but I don't actually write the password. So I might sort of say, I'll make this up, obviously. password for this is...
Can I just write it down?
Yeah, please. Yeah. We're recording. It's all friendly. Dog Street. And it could be, I had a dog called Fido, and the house number of the street I live in is 55. So it's Fido 55. So someone picking that up would probably have, if they were able to get at it, probably not exactly be able to read it exactly what it is. But if they knew enough about me, if they hacked into my Facebook account and found that, you know, I keep on talking about Fido, this fantastic thing, then that blows that theory. So I'm a little bit smarter than that, hopefully. But, it's and obviously when you get those emails, you've just won $1 million, give me, they're not real. Yes, anyone? Is anyone online has a question? All silent, stunned.
I'm just going back to the IT department. Your example earlier on where you said the guy said he just goes to LinkedIn and then he gets phone books and ends up at the IT department where they've all got 16-character passwords saved on their computer. So are you recommending that we just do away with really big passwords?
No, not at all. I think that... It's similar to my previous answer. You can have a series of passwords that can be extremely strong that you can remember. I mean, and it could be a combination of, a location that you went to in your last holiday that was really good, and you put an exclamation mark and an ampersand at various parts in it. But if it's password with the O with a zero, that is not strong.
Yeah. But that's still only 8 characters.
Depends on where you went. If you went to Cinque Terre, then you... So there are a variety of ways that you can actually make strong passwords that you can remember. Just don't write them down. Mm. And it becomes probably tougher when the DBAs need to share those passwords with other senior system administrators. So... it's then what you have. Do you have a lockbox? Do you have something? How do you then secure those? But look, there are ways and techniques to handle that. And part of the PCI DSS, which is when credit card protection came in, they actually, I won't say legislate, but they talk about how you should keep encrypted keys. So as long as you do it, where it comes falls over is humans. Humans always want a shortcut. I don't want to go through all the hassle of getting it out of the lockbox and do this. I'll just write it down here and have you all know I'm secure. Wrong.
Yep. If you do happen to have a device that is breached or hacked, what can you do?
Take it to your security team, mm-hmm. and don't touch it. Okay. I know a number of corporations, and I was chatting to a gent behind you, that when they send a delegation to China, they will buy everyone new phones, they'll give them those phones to be used while they're in China, they'll collect the phones when they come out and go back. And I'm told that people are now doing that when they go to the States as well. That the chances are if you take any electronic device into mainland China, 99.99% chance it's going to be compromised by the time you come out. So once it's been compromised, you don't know how or where. Running Norton anti-scan is not going to clean it up. The best thing is just to hand it over and hope that you've got your data elsewhere and you can grab it from there. Okay, thanks.
Just reflecting to the question just now and some discussions we had before, it sounds all doom and gloom, but eventually an institution would be compromised at one point or another. So you can, as long as the government and the governance and the 8 points that you highlighted are in place, you've done your due diligence. After that, what are the key components on crisis management that needs to be done once it's done, once it's compromised?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really important thing to think about. You're right. I think that every company must consider that at some stage they're going to have a data breach and it'll become known. Certainly with legislation, they are now having to report it. And I think that was, you know, we should have had that legislation a long time ago. Part of the legislation is that you need to indicate what data has been taken, and these are my words, not theirs, it's very bureaucratic wordage, but how can that data be used? What impact is that data going to have? And what do you need to tell your customers about, you know, we've lost this data, this could possibly mean you now need to do the following steps. I think that you really need to look at that in a step-by-step process as to how you would go out and inform your customers of the impact of that. And I've always believed that if most transparency you can have, the better you're going to be in the long run.
Thank you all for attending today's session. I hope you've all gained greater insight into the digital world that we are all living in. And please join me in thanking Ian for his time.